We're doing Parashat Baalotcha. We've begun the Book of Amidbar, and we saw the countings, the procession of the Jewish people, how we're supposed to have our camp with the flags and where each one is situated, the countings of the tribes and the Levim. And now we're holding Parashat Baalotcha. Parashat seems to take us off on a tangent, back to a topic that would seem to belong more in Sefer Shmos or Vayikra, tells us about how Aaron should light the candles in the menorah, that the candles are all supposed to be facing one direction, either all facing center or all facing towards the Holy of Holies to the west. And Aaron does as God tells him. He does the menorah the way it should be. God tells Moshe, take the Levim and special procession for the Levim. They're going to be shaved bald, and they're going to be anointed, and they're going to be lifted like a sacrifice is lifted, and the Jews will place their hands on them, and the Levim will take the place of the Bechoros. They will be in service in place of the firstborns. Hashem tells us that the Levim can serve from age 25 and up. Previously the Torah said 30 and up, and we'll discuss that discrepancy later. And after they hit the age of 50, so then they're told to retire, which is a halacha that was only relevant in the desert. And we're holding by Shlishi. And now the Torah goes back to Rosh Chodesh, to the beginning of Nisan. And we have the commandment to bring the Korban Pesach, which is a little bit interesting, because the Torah said in Egypt, bring the Pesach in Egypt. And then God said, and you'll bring it in the land of Israel. And now suddenly we haven't made it to the land of Israel. We hit a second year of Pesach. And God says, bring it here in the desert. The Torah tells us that there were people who were tummy. They were spiritually defiled. They cannot participate in the Pesach. They came forward and asked, why should we be left out? And Moshe says, wait, let me ask God. And God says, no, if they're tamei, they cannot participate. They'll go to Pesach Sheni, and we get introduced to the concept that there's an alternate Pesach. Those who don't make it for the first Pesach, for the sacrifice, can bring a Pesach Sheni. The Torah seems to, again, go off on a tangent. Our parasha seems to be a bunch of tangents just put together, and we'll try to find the common thread when we go over it again. Torah tells us how the Jews would travel. When it came time to travel, so the special cloud that was over the Mishkan would fold up, and then the Jews would follow the cloud, and sometimes it would stay situated for a day, a month, a year, and sometimes and whenever it went, they'd go. God tells Moshe, make yourself special solid silver trumpets, and you'll use them to gather the congregation and to tell them when it's time to travel and to gather the leaders. And this is a special halacha for Moshe. And then the Torah tells us that we're supposed to blow trumpets also when there's a time of danger, when the enemies attack. This is halacha for generations. And when we bring sacrifices, we'll blow the trumpets and everyone will hear the trumpets. They'll know the sacrifices are being brought and the sacrifices are representative of the Jewish people. They'll have in mind, hey, it's my sacrifice being brought now. We're holding by Chamishi. We're almost finished the parasha. The Torah tells us that it came time to travel. We're leaving Sinai. We've been situated at Sinai ever since the middle of Sefer Shmos. And the Torah describes the procession, how God had told us we should travel. That's how we traveled. And it seems like we're headed for the Holy Land. We've left to the desert. We've left Egypt. The whole purpose was to get the Torah and then go to the land of Israel. We got the Torah. We've been at Sinai. Now it's time to go to Israel. So Moshe calls in his father-in-law and he says, come with us. Now why does he have to tell his father come with us? Obviously he sees his father-in-law is hesitant. His father-in-law is contemplating leaving. And his father-in-law has good reason not to join, because his father-in-law is not one of the Jewish people. He's a Midianite priest who converted to Judaism. And he's not going to have a portion in the land of Israel. So Gerim don't get a portion in the land of Israel. So Moshe tells him, come along and we'll make good to you. And later on we'll discuss what was Moshe really promising him when he says we'll make good to you. And Israel says, you're promising me that you'll figure out a way of making good to me. Back in my home country, I know it's going to be good for me. I have my property. I have my money. I have my family. I have my assets. I'm going back home. And Moshe begs him, please don't leave. When things will be good for us, we'll make sure it's good for you. And the Torah doesn't tell us what happened. Did Israel go? Did Israel not go? The Torah doesn't tell us. Later on, we'll discuss what really happened. We travel. We do 3 days' journey in a day. And here, really, we're about to enter the section of the book of the Midbar. We're going to see one downfall after another. The Jewish people are plummeting. And they've left Sinai. And from there, it's like, whew, downhill. Before we're introduced to the downfalls, the Torah interjects a parsha about Vayhi bin Soharon. We have written into the Sefer Torah backwards nuns. You look at the Sefer Torah when they do Hagbah Glilo, or if you get an Aliyah, or if you could sneak over and peek, you'll see in the Sefer Torah, that's our tradition, we have backwards nuns here. And those are to separate one before these Pesukim and one after. And it describes how we travel. Before we travel, Moshe would say Tfil Saderach. God, take care of us. Our enemies, scatter them. Interesting. They're traveling with the Aron. They have the heavenly cloud above them. But before they travel, Moshe has to make a Tfil Saderach. Vayi bin Soharon, vayomer Moshe. He'd say, Kuma Hashem v'yofutzo evecha. Arise Hashem, scatter our enemies. V'anusu misanecha mipanecha. Okay? And then when we'd come to camp, so Moshe would pray, Shuvah Hashem revot afei Yisrael. Please bring back the thousands. Everyone should make it back in peace. We should settle. And we shouldn't lose anyone along the way. So what's that all about? The nation starts complaining. This isn't the nation, this is really the Erev Rav. And God punishes them, a fire comes out and consumes the edge of the camp. What's it talking about? Very enigmatic. You read the Psukim in our Parsha, and the Torah seems to be telling us a lot of things without telling us what it's telling us. So we have a tradition that they were looking for complaints. Now why were they looking for complaints? Because when you're situated at Sinai and the Jewish people are united and everyone's learning the Torah, it's like being in yeshiva. It's easy to get up for minyan. It's easy to keep Shabbos the way you've learned. But suddenly we left Sinai. This is the first time we have to fend for ourselves. We're out in the desert. And it's not so comfortable when you have to leave the enclave of Sinai and fend for yourself religiously. And suddenly people remember, hey, things were once a little bit easier before we got this Torah. So they start complaining. And they don't have anything specific to complain about. They're looking for what to complain about. So they complain. And the first thing is the lowest people in the nation complain. And God sends a fire and Moshe prays. And the nation comes to Moshe. They beg him to pray for them. Moshe prays and the fire goes down. And no sooner does the threat of the fire disappear, the nation starts crying again. And they start saying, we wish we had meat. Back in Egypt, you could get fish for free. Where do you get fish for free if they're slaves? So we'll discuss that. We remember all the different types of vegetables and the spices we'd spice our meat with. Now all we got is this man. And the Torah tells us how wonderful the man really was, but they were looking for something to complain about. And Moshe hears this, and Moshe turns to God and he says, what'd you put me responsible for this nation? How could I handle this? Am I their mother? I'm supposed to carry them alone. How could I give them so much meat? They're all begging for meat. I can't do this. If this is what you do, if you're leaving me responsible for this nation, then let me die. I can't handle this. And the question is, what happened this time differently than all the other times? When they sinned in the Egel, Moshe doesn't say this. When they sinned in the Meraglim in next week's Parsha, Moshe doesn't say this. So why? What's the exception? Why over here does Moshe suddenly say, I can't handle this, God? So God says, okay, Moshe, gather 70 people, we'll establish the Zkenim, they'll go out of the camp with you, and I'll give you prophecy, and they'll get some of your prophecy, just like one candle lights another candle, you'll stand out there, and they'll get your prophecy, and then I'll give them meat. So they'll have meat for a month. And Moshe says, we have a nation here of 600,000 people. You're going to give them meat for a month? Are we going to slaughter animals for them? How are we going to ensure we have kosher slaughter for so many people? How are we going to do this? You're going to gather all the fish in the sea that don't need slaughtering? Well, what are you going to do? And God says, what do you mean? Am I limited? You'll see, I'll do it. So Moshe gathers the 70 people. They get prophecy with him. And there are two people left behind inside the camp. And we'll have to discuss why they were left behind inside the camp. And they start prophesizing. And they start saying all kinds of scary things. Moshe is going to die. Yeshua is going to lead the people into the land. So you have two prophets inside the camp, and they're not doing what the 70 others are doing. The 70 others, God said, I'll give them part of your prophecy. So they're all going in line with Moshe. Everyone's attesting to the fact that Moshe is running the show, and they're subservient to him. Here we have two people inside the camp that are threatening mutiny, really. they're suddenly prophets. Suddenly we have new prophets inside the camp, two individual prophets. And so the people get nervous. A lad, Moshe's son, or Yoshua, runs out to Moshe and says, Eldad and Medad, they're prophesizing inside the camp. And when Yoshua hears what they said that he'd run the show and Moshe would die, so he tells Moshe, put him in jail. And Moshe says, what, are you jealous for me? How by everyone should be prophets. Let God give a spirit upon everyone. These 70 people needed it from me, but the other two, if they merited it, if they're on a level that they could attain their own prophecy, that's great. Everyone should attain that level. They come back into the camp. God sends the special slav, which is some kind of bird fish, some kind of bird that frequents by the sea. The people asked for fish and bird and meat. So God says, I'll give you the flavor of all of them in one. I'll give you a bird that has meat that flies by the fish that's found by the sea. So it has the salty taste of the sea and the taste of meat. You'll get all the tastes you wanted. That's what the people wanted. They start eating it and people drop dead on the spot. Some people get sick and they die after 30 days. But everyone dies, not everyone, but a lot of people die from eating this meat because they had it spoken improperly about Hashem. And our parsha ends with the story of Miriam and Aaron speaking about the black woman that Moshe married. Moshe married Tzipporah, we know, Yisro's daughter, and Tzipporah was exceptionally beautiful both physically and spiritually. She was a beautiful person. She was so exceptional that just like when someone is black and he stands among white people, he stands out, so too she stood out in her beauty in physical and spiritual. So when she was standing there and she saw the two Eldad and Medad start prophesizing inside the camp and they're attaining the level that they get their own prophecy like Moshe Rabbeinu, they don't need Moshe to get off of Moshe's prophecy. So she says, oh, I pity their wives. So Miriam says, what do you pity their wives for? So she says, well, since Moshe got his prophecy like that, he hasn't been with me. We're basically living like two single people in a tent. And I pity their wives. So Miriam hears this, and Miriam goes over to her brother Aaron and says, we got to help Moshe. He's got shalom bias issues here. How come he left his wife? We get prophecy, and we've attained prophecy, and we didn't leave our wives. Now, Moshe was really very humble, the humblest person that ever lived, the Torah attests in our parsha. And so God wants to explain to Aaron and Miriam. So God appears to all three of them, Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam, at once and says, get out, go out of the camp. Aaron and Miriam had just been with their spouses and they weren't completely pure. So Aaron and Miriam, they start yelling, water, we need water, we can't handle this. When a person isn't spiritually pure and he suddenly gets a level of prophecy that he's unable to handle, so he feels like, I can't handle this right now. So God says, listen now, I'm not letting you have the option of going to Tevel. You wanted to understand Moshe? If I speak to any other prophet, I don't speak to him like Moshe. Any other prophet has a dream, they see a vision. Moshe is truthful throughout my home. I speak to him straight, like a friend speaks to a friend. I don't give him the visions like other prophets to interpret, but he gets the exact words we speak straight, me and him. How were you not fearful to speak about Moshe, who's my servant? He's got these two things going for him. He's exceptional, he's Moshe, and he's my servant. I told him not to go back to his wife. When he came up to me at Sinai, I told him, go tell the Jews to all go back to their wives. They had to separate for the wives 3 days prior to accepting the Torah. Now go tell them all to go back to their wives, and you stick around with me. I clearly indicated to him that he can't go back to his wife. He's got to be available at all times to get prophecy.
And told
all this to them. Yeah, Shem said this to Aaron and Miriam, and because they had attained prophecy at a time when they weren't fit for it, so when a person jumps to heights that he's not ready for, one of the things that can happen is that they get tzaras. So when God leaves, so Aaron looks at Miriam and she has tzaras. You know the old joke, a guy wants to understand what Talmud is. So he asks his friend, tell me, what's Talmud? So he says, Talmud is the following. Two robbers go down the chimney, and they come into a house. Which one washes his face? So he says, I don't know. So he says, well, the first one, he got dirty because he went down. He collected all the soot on his face. The second one, he didn't get dirty. So which one washes his face? So the guy says, well, the first one, he got all dirty. So he says, wrong, the second one. Because he sees the first one dirty, he assumes he's dirty too. So he washes his face. The second one, he sees the first one sees the second one who's clean, so he figures, oh, I'm also clean, so he doesn't bother washing his face. So he says, ah, now I understand. So he says, okay, you want to understand Talmud? Two robbers go down chimney. The first one gets his face covered with soot, the second one doesn't. which one washes his face? So he said, oh, I know, the second one, the one whose face is clean. So he says, wrong. He says, why am I wrong? So he says, well, the second one, he comes down the chimney, he sees the first one's face is dirty, so he goes to wash his face. He's going to wash his face. The first one says, oh, he must think I'm dirty. So he also goes to wash his face. So they both wash their faces. He says, oh, I got it. Okay, that's Talmud. Okay. So two robbers go down the chimney. The first one gets dirty. The second one doesn't. Which one washes his face? So et cetera. It goes on and on. I mean, you guys get the idea. So Aaron looks at Miriam. The Torah only identifies that Miriam got saras. But it's really unclear to our sages whether Aaron also got saras. The Torah says Aaron looked at Miriam and saw that she had saras. And then what? According to one understanding, he realized that he also had saras. He couldn't see himself. He saw Miriam and he realized he also had it. And the pasuk covers it up out of respect for Aaron. And the other understanding says that no, Aaron got a lesser punishment because she instigated the whole conversation. And Aaron begs Moshe, pray for our sister. And Moshe prays to Hashem, his short prayer, El Norefa No La. And God says, you know, if her father were upset at her, she'd be out for 7 days. Certainly, she spoke badly against you. She spoke badly against me. She deserves 14. You're forgiving her your 7, but she's still left with my 7. After 7 days, she'll be cured. And Miriam remains out of the camp for 7 days, and everyone waits around for Miriam. And then we continue our travels towards the land of Israel. We're about to enter the land of Israel. Yeah. Okay. Let's. Yeah.
Wasn't that she said Lashon Hara? The point was that in a level of impurity, when you.
No, point was the Lashon Hara. The point was Lashon Hara. Tzaraas comes for Lashon Hara. Tzaraas can also come when a person isn't fit for a spiritual level and he tries. When Uzzah goes into the Holy of Holies and he's not fit for it, so Tzaraas bursts forth on his forehead. He tries to attain spiritual height he's not ready for, so tzaraas plagues him. Yeah.
Is Lashon Hara why they didn't enter Israel?
That we'll discuss next week, Bezrat Hashem. Yeah. So we're up to Parshas Baal Oschah. Now we'll go through the Parsha with a little bit more depth. The Torah tells us that God tells Moshe, tell Aaron, when he lifts up the candles, the neros, what's a ner? Ner is a cup that holds the oil and the wick that we light. But it's the cup. Ner in Tanakh, in the Gemara, ner is that cup that houses the wick, like a lamp, that houses the wick and the oil. So when Aaron picks up the flame, he has directions how he should light it. He should align the wicks in a way that three are on the right are facing the center, and the three on the left are facing the center. All the wicks are facing the center. That's one understanding. So what does it mean to uplift? So one understanding says he climbs up a ladder to get there. Which is a little strange because it's unclear how high the menorah was. According to one understanding, it was 10 tefachim, making it about this high. It's unclear exactly how tall the menorah was, what he needed a ladder for. So when Aaron goes up the steps to light the flames, so it's described that he lifts up the flame. And from here our sages derive that he'd have to leave the candle there or whatever he was lighting with. He'd have to leave the flame there until the flame caught and was lighting on its own. What's called meaning when you light a wick, you could just touch the flame and then till it catches. And once it starts catching, you move away the flame. That's what most of us do. The Torah tells us that when Aaron lights the flames on the menorah, he has to leave the flame there until the majority of the wick is already lit. Now what do you gain when you do that? When you take away the flame, you're not taking away from the fire. The fire, if you leave your candle by the wick until the wick is mostly lit already, when you pull away your candle, then the wick doesn't, then the flame doesn't go down. So this concept our sages taught us we have to apply to the menorah we light on Hanukkah as well. When we light on Hanukkah our candles, we should leave the flame by the candle till the majority of the wick is lit. And on Shabbos also, a person should preferably, when he lights candles, light that way. Yeah?
When they're walking in the desert, do they light the menorah facing south?
What do you mean? Why?
Well, in the Beit HaMikdash, they always face it south for wisdom. So do they do so walking in the desert?
You don't mean facing, you mean where was it situated?
Where
it was situated, yeah. Where it was facing, there are two opinions in the Gemara, and it's in the Mishnah, it's unclear what the conclusion is. when they lit the menorah, so we have special laws as to how the menorah is supposed to be built. The Torah says it's supposed to be from solid gold. Meaning you take a block of gold and you chisel out the shape of the menorah. Now, when God said this to Moshe, Moshe had difficulty. He had difficulty picturing it. So God showed him a picture. And after God showed him a picture, so there are two understandings among our sages. Either Moshe said, okay, now I got it and did it. Or Moshe said, I see it, but I don't know how to do it. And Moshe tried to figure out how to do it, and he couldn't get it. And then God said, okay, I'll do it for you. Throw the block of gold into the fire, and you'll have a menorah come out of it. So the Torah gives us three laws with regard to the menorah. That the wicks have to be facing the west, or the middle candle. That it has to be of gold, and this isn't makiv. Worst comes worst, if you don't get gold, when the Hasmoneans entered the temple, they couldn't afford a gold menorah. So it can be made from another metal. It doesn't have to be out of gold. And it has to be of one solid piece. Now, does all of the menorah have to be of one solid piece? The simple understanding says yes. But there is an understanding that says that the top cups were not made of the same piece. And you had the menorah of one piece, and the cups which held the wicks and the oil, they were separate. And that's why it says, Beha lotcha, when you pick up the cups to place them on the menorah. If you quote this to people, they'll say, no, you got it all wrong. But this is an opinion. It's not a known opinion, but it is. Yeah.
Isn't there also an opinion which says that only the middle one, the straight one, is the menorah, and the other one are just adding to the actual menorah, and that only the central part has to be out of massive gold?
Never heard of it. Show me. I don't know. I never heard of it. Yeah.
How do they make the shape when you're not supposed to use iron for... Iron is used for war and cannons and everything.
I don't think that's said with regard to the menorah. And even where it is said, so there's a machlokas, when we say you can't use metal instruments to fashion them is beyach, so then there are two understandings in our sages. Does it mean that by the temple they couldn't use metal instruments, but when they wanted to fashion the stone outside the temple, so then in the mountains where they'd quarry the stones, they'd use metal to fashion the stones, or does it mean they never used metal? Two understandings in Chazal, but that's not with regard to the menorah. The menorah they chiseled out, they banged it to give it its shape. Our whole parsha, when it discusses the menorah, does not mention Ohel Moed because this is a commandment for generations. And people would think that the Ohel Moed is a tent, so it's dark, right? You don't have windows in the Ohel Moed, so they had to have some other source of lighting. So people would think the commandment of the menorah is only inside the Ohel Moed. You come to the Beis HaMikdash, then you have a permanent building and you have light, you have windows. They had windows in the Beis HaMikdash. You won't need a menorah. So that's why the parasha doesn't make mention of Ohel Moed when it commands about the menorah. To allude to us, this has nothing to do with the fact that it's a tent. The menorah is not there for light. Now why would we think it is there for light? Because the menorah is lit in the evening. When it gets dark in the afternoon, that's when they lit the menorah. So people would think, yeah, right. Why do you light a menorah in the afternoon, in the evening when it gets dark? Because you need light. And God says, no, I gave the Jewish people light all the 40 years they were traveling in the desert. I don't need light. If I wanted light, I'd say spread out the wicks. I don't say that. I say put all the wicks together. They're all facing the center. That's to illustrate that God's saying, I don't need your light. I'm saying this is a way of honoring the Mishkan. But I don't need it for the light. Yeah. Not following you.
When there's an enumeration of all the mitzvot, there is one mitzvah for the tabernacle, for the mishkan, and included in that is the our old vessels and the menorah. But there's no separate mitzvah for.
So therefore, what? I'm not following. And that and.
Therefore, in light of this, is there a contradiction?
To what? What contradicts? Not found. I'm saying one might think it's separate. It isn't separate. One might think that this is a separate issue, the menorah, that it's only there for the Ohel Moed. And that's why the Torah doesn't make mention of Ohel Moed in this commandment to teach us that it's part of the shape that the temple has to have. Not, it's not contingent on Ohel Moed in the Beis HaMikdash as well. So that's interesting. The Rambam, when he describes the menorah, describes it one way, and then he says, I'll show you an illustration, which is exact differently. It's like his illustration is curved, and his description is diagonal. And so the illustration doesn't match the description. He says, I'm drawing you a picture, and the picture doesn't match what he writes. So that's a question we have. We don't know what the Rambam meant by that.
I read something Kabbalistically it's supposed to be straight.
Okay. Okay, let's continue. So we have the menorah, and we have the commandment about how to light the menorah and how the menorah is supposed to be. And then we're told the Levim, so the Levim are going to get their position that they have to be shaved bald, and then they're going to immerse themselves in mikveh water, and then the Jews are all going to place their hands on them. The Bechorim, representing the Jews, are going to place their hands like smicha. We know that when one attains a level of spirituality, so then one of the ways we do it is by putting hands on him. When parents bless their children Friday night, they place their hands on them. When Moshe gives Yeshua the level of leading the Jewish people, he places his hand on them. The Chizkuni points out that in his time, the knights used to do this. When you'd get knighthood, so they'd place their hands on the person's head and tell him that he became a knight. So the Chizkuni says, don't get it wrong. We did it first. They copied us. The fact that knights do this is that they copied us. But in the Torah, he says, anytime you place your hands on a human, it's to show that you're giving him a special level. And so the Bechorim are placing their hands on the Levim to show that they're taking their place. Now, the Levim are shaved and they're immersed. And the reason is because they're coming in place of the Bechorim who served the Egel. And when one serves idols, so he's considered tameh like a metzorah. And just like a metzorah has to shave his body, so to these Levim are coming in place of the Bechorim who did avod zarah, shave their body. And this is the source for the minhag that when a person either is chozer b'tshuva from another religion or becomes a ger from another religion, he shaves his hair and immerses himself. Now this minhag is brought in the Ramah and Shulchan Aruch. It's brought in certain versions, the Chizkuni's version of Rashi on our parsha. It's brought in the Shulchan Aruch in Hilchos Chol HaMoed. But recently, many Bate Dinim don't do this. Imagine a woman wants to come become a Gioris and they tell her you have to shave your hair off. And that's not an easy thing to do. So today, two things. Many Bate Dinim forego this custom. And even those Bate Dinim who say to do the custom, don't make people shave clean. What I've seen is they tell them to take a very close haircut. And I don't understand exactly, because the Levim had to really shave everything off. And the ancient custom was, what's brought in the Ramah, is that when a person did tshuva or became a ger, until he shaved all his hair and went to mikveh, they wouldn't count him as one of the minyan. Meaning the person's a Jew. He did tshuva. Now it's... It wasn't the only... Not for a ger, it was another thing that they had to do. A ger always has to go to mikveh. But about tshuva, the man was born Jewish. Why? What are? This is a custom. It doesn't have a source. The source is here, but it's a custom. And nonetheless, the custom was so strong that they wouldn't count a person for a minyan until he did this. And so much so that they permitted a person to take haircut on Chol HaMoed. Even though ordinarily we don't take haircut on Chol HaMoed, they said, "Yeah, but he can't become part of the minyan." But he could. This is a custom that's. It's very difficult to find the source. This is the source that's quoted, but it's difficult. Just saying, David. Yeah.
Question. They went in a way that they saw if he would do it or not.
What can I say?
Did he do it in the end?
Yeah.
When was this custom
so I know that even today there are many Bate Dinim who insist on it, and there are some Bate Dinim who don't. So it's not really put aside. Some put it aside and some don't.
But when did some of them start?
I've only heard of it lately. Okay, I haven't yet found responsa that discuss it. I don't think it's old. I think it's fresh. That but they didn't are willing to forgo it. But I haven't done enough research. Could be it says it somewhere. Yeah.
Is a person part of tshuva?
About tshuva who was in a different religion. If a person just didn't know anything, then not. This is because we say when one deals with avod zarah, he becomes tamei. And he's leaving Tumah, so we say, just like one who leaves Tumah of Tzarat does this, so too one who leaves the Tumah of Avodah Zarah. But that's only if he was there. If he was an atheist, or if he was just not knowledgeable and didn't know anything, so then I don't think that would apply, as far as Tshuva goes.
The shaving of the Kohanim included everything?
Yeah, that's why Korach's wife is going to get all upset in 2 weeks. Korach walks home after our parsha, and he's all shaved, And his wife says, "Who did this to you? You're shaved like a cucumber. What happened here?" That's the Medrash's term. That's what she told him. She said to him, "Migilachotcha kedalat." Yeah. So he said, "Moshe did this to me." So she says, "Where is he getting all this from?" And she egged him on. Yeah. No, only the Levim were coming in place of the Kohanim. I don't know why. It's a good point. All the Jews should have had to do it. I don't know why not. So the Torah tells us special sacrifices that the Levim bring, as though in atonement of the Avodah Zarah that was done. Yeah. One second. No. Yeah.
Also the hair on the side.
Everything. So it seems like, yeah. Well, you can have a Ras Shah. You're talking about a ger or about tshuva?
About the
Kohen. What? In the time of the Torah? So we know that the Torah could give us, a Navi could give a Ras Shah. A Navi could say, now you do this. Mitzorah also has to shave everything.
We're not supposed to cut the hair and shave the hair on the side.
Right.
Right,
I think so.
Yeah.
Right, Kohanim wear shatnez. Right, over there it's a seido chelosa. It's a little bit different, but yeah.
Why is the Levim the only ones who didn't transgress among females, and yet they're the ones who have to do a Kohanim for?
They're coming in place of the Bechoros who did transgress, and the reason they're coming instead of the Bechoros is because the Bechoros transgressed and served the eagle. So God is saying, you come in their stead. And when they're coming in their stead, so they're taking upon themselves the atonement of the Bechoros. So as part of the atonement is they're shaving themselves, they're bringing sacrifices that ordinarily are brought when one mistakenly serves idols. They're coming in place of the Bechoros. So they're bringing the sacrifices for the Bechoros. It's interesting that Aaron had to pick up every Levi and do tnufa, wave him around. And Aaron was 83, 84 years old. That's not an easy feat. I don't know. I guess he was strong. Yeah?
Even today, Levim don't have to wear shatnez.
No. Kohanim were permitted to wear shatnez only in the time that they were serving in the Beis HaMikdash. That the special garments that Torah says they should wear in the Beis HaMikdash, one of the garments was a mixture. If I'm not mistaken, it was one. The avnet was a mixture of wool and linen. It was tcheles and bad. Bad is linen. So that garment, when they were serving in the Beis HaMikdash, the Torah says they should wear that garment. So that's what they wore of shatnez. But they are obligated in keeping the mitzvah of shatnez with regard to everything else. Yeah, okay. So the Levim are coming in place of the Kohanim. And now we have a total switch within Judaism. Until this point, every firstborn was supposed to be doing some kind of service in the temple. And if you think about it, that's a little bit complicated because my father was not firstborn. So then my firstborn brother, where is he going to learn from what a Levi is supposed to do? And that's what God says. Now that I'm making the Levim instead of the Yisraelim, there won't be a negative in Israel. The Jews will have a much easier time keeping up with the laws of Levim because each Levi will learn from his father how he's supposed to behave. Until now, a person has to come into service and he doesn't know anything. I mean, ask any rabbi today, laws of korbanos, they'll stumble up. Like the Rambam says, the Rambam himself writes that there was a certain court case that came before his court. So the Rambam says, of course we have it easy because in our country we deal with these cases. The previous court that had to deal with this case, they don't get these cases often. So they don't know how to work out the halachas in this case. The Rambam gives this example. It's as though they'd come before our court in a question in the halachas of the Beis HaMikdash. That we'd also stumble on the simplest things that every child knew back in the time that everyone was performing these halachas when we had a temple. So halachas that we're familiar with, we know what to do. Halachas we're not familiar with, we don't know what to do. Call a rabbi in Chutz Laretz and ask him the laws of Shemitah. Most rabbis won't know to answer you. Call a rabbi in Israel. Well, they're dealing with it. Everyone's asking questions now. And they'll all be asking questions next year. So every rabbi has to know it. That's what's happening here. The Levim, now that it's within one family, that they're responsible for these jobs in the temple, so then they'll master these laws. And everyone within the Levim will know it. the Torah says the Levim are going to come in place of the Jews, the rest of the Jews, as though the Jews didn't live up to what they were supposed to do. Not as though. The Jews didn't. We didn't live up to our job. And then the next pasuk says, the Levim will be in place of Bnei Yisrael, and they're going to serve in place of Bnei Yisrael, and they'll be before me in place of Bnei Yisrael. 5 times the pasuk repeats Bnei Yisrael. And that pasuk is coming to show us how much God loves the Jewish people. That even though we didn't live up to what we're supposed to do, God says in one pasuk, I'm going to mention them 5 times, like the Chamisha Chumshei Torah, to show how much I love them. Now, it says that the Levim, what? Pasuk Yud Tes. The Torah says the Levim enter when they're 25 and they start working when they're 30, which is to indicate to us that a person who's trying to get his Mishnayos down pat has to take 5 years to see if he's successful or not. Yeah, the Levim took 5 years to learn the laws. If you get it within 5 years, good. If after 5 years of trying to review Maseches Brachos, you still don't get the Mishnayos down pat, so you know you're not cut out for learning. But that's learning Mishnayos by heart. That's getting the Mishnayos down pat. People think this applies to any form of learning. No, when it comes to learning Gemara, when it comes to understanding, that's going to take more. That takes davening, that takes Yata Deshmaya. That's different. When it comes to getting down the Mishnayos, which today is less relevant, we don't learn Mishnayos by heart. There, Chazal said, even on something as simple as that, give yourself 5 years. Don't assume within a year I'm not cut out for this. No, you can never chuck it. After 5, if you decide that for some reason you're not fit for it, you can't get it, so then you have to start supporting other people who are fit for it. That's Allah and Shulchan Aruch. That one who cannot learn Torah should support others who can learn Torah. The Torah tells us over here, the Torah retracts and goes back a month and a half and tells us that when the beginning of the month of Nisan came, God said, don't forget Pesach. What's the concern? When we built the first temple, so the temple was built in the beginning of Tishrei. And the Jews were busy rejoicing for 14 days. And they overrode Yom Kippur. No one kept Yom Kippur that year. King Solomon made a decree. He said, we're busy rejoicing for the building of the temple. No one has to keep Yom Kippur this year. So that year, no one fasted. Yom Kippur that year, they didn't fast. Yom Kippur fell out in the 7 days of rejoicing, the 14 days of rejoicing for the building of the temple. So they were atoned. Yeah, they got atonement. They needed atonement for not fasting. They got atonement for that too. This is in the Navi. Shivat Yamim v'Shivat Yamim. So this, says in the Navi.
This really shows the concept that the Torah is in
there. Right. It shows the power a rabbi can have, at least in those days. And God is telling us over here, he didn't do it as a king, he did it as a rabbi. He did it with Talmudic basis, Shlomo HaMelech. So God is telling us, now that you're erecting the Mishkan, and you're having all these celebrations for 12 days, you're bringing the sacrifices of the Nesim, don't forget Pesach's coming up. In 14 days, meaning God said this in the beginning of Nisan, we're going to have 12 days of celebration, and God says, and don't forget, you keep that Korban Pesach. God had told us, when we were doing Pesach in Egypt, you'll do the next Pesach in Israel. And now we're holding by the next Pesach, we're not in Israel, so God says, don't forget, I want you to do Pesach here in the desert. Now, this is the only Passover, which we kept the 40 years we were in the desert, because next week's Parsha we're going to see the Jews sinned, and it was decreed they would spend the next 38 years in the desert, and those 38 years they didn't circumcise their children, and the Torah says that if one hasn't circumcised his child, he cannot bring a Korban Pesach. So the next 38 years the Jews don't bring a Korban Pesach until we enter the land of Israel, and then we have mass circumcision and we bring the Korban Pesach. So Rashi says the Torah did not begin the book of Bamidbar with this story, because the Torah over here is telling us the Jews will bring the Paschal offering this year. And we have on tradition that was the only year we brought the Paschal offering. All the other years we didn't. And the Torah didn't want to begin the book of Bamidbar with our disgrace. So you ask yourself, what's the disgrace? The Torah is discussing how we did bring the Paschal offering that year. And I think from here we see how careful we have to be about disgracing someone else. Someone walks in and you say, oh, he's great at learning Chumash. So that's a compliment, but it could also be an inference. He hasn't yet mastered Mishnah and Gemara. And even if it's said as a compliment, but the understanding is going to be that he hasn't yet mastered other things, so then that's called disgracing someone. The Torah didn't want to begin the book of Bamidbar with telling us that the Jews kept the Paschal offering this year, because we would know by inference that really we didn't keep the other years. The Torah tells us, keep Pesach at its set time. And twice the Torah stresses it in our parsha to tell us, even if it falls out on Shabbos, we bring the Pesach offering, even if all of the Jewish people are tummy. How could it be all of the Jewish people are tummy? So there's a mitzvah when a leader of the Jewish people passes away to go and be part of his Leviyah and become tummy. Meaning if the Nasi, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, passed away, all of the Jewish people had a mitzvah to go to his Leviyah. When a leader of the Jewish people passes away, so everyone has to go to the Leviyah. So it happened once that one of the kings or one of the Nesim passed away. I don't remember which one, the Gemara says. He passed away just before Pesach. So everyone went and everyone became tummy. Now that everyone's tummy, the Torah tells us in our parsha, keep Pesach. And if an individual is tummy, he could do Pesach Sheni. And from here we derive only individuals do Pesach Sheni. But if the majority of the congregation is tummy, then we're allowed to bring the Korban Pesach even when everyone is tummy. Moshe tells the Jewish people the laws of the Pesach. And here we see an important rule. Moshe had told them everything beforehand. Moshe had told us all the laws of the Yom Tov. But every time a Yom Tov came up, Moshe would say, guys, let's review the laws of this Yom Tov. Very often we feel like, I know that, I've learned it. And we see from Moshe Rabbeinu that when the time comes, we're nearing a Yom Tov, we should learn the laws of that Yom Tov. And for all you guys, this is important when you're in the Machon. This is important after you get married. A person should have a Seder sometime during his day when he's preparing for the next Yom Tov. So what's coming up? The 3 weeks, Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, the 9 days, Tisha B'Av, you guys review the laws. If you didn't, you should start. Take out a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, take out a Chai Adam, and start learning those laws. You learn 2 laws a day. By the time you reach Shiva Asar B'Tammuz and the 9 days, you'll know the laws well. You finish with Tisha B'Av, start preparing, because the month of Tishrei has a lot. You have all of the laws of Rosh Hashanah, you have all the laws of Yom Kippur, all the laws of Sukkot, all the laws of buying an Estrog and Lulav, and this year you could add to that all the laws of Shemitah. Because this coming year is Shemitah, so you have to prepare with those laws as well. So there's a lot of work for the next 3 months. Meaning we have 3 months till Rosh Hashanah now. And in 3-4 months, we're going to be standing with all these questions. We're going to have to know the laws of Shemitah. What can you buy? What can't you buy? If you buy something that's Otzer Bezdin, what can you do with the peel? If you want to peel a cucumber, cucumber peels are edible. So are you allowed to throw it out? Or do you have to put it in a bag and then when it rots, bury it? Or do you double bag it and then throw it out? What hechshers do you eat on Shemitah? What may you buy? What may you not buy? So the laws of Shemitah we have to know. And then we're going to have to know the laws of Rosh Hashanah, laws of hearing shofar, the laws of atonement towards Rosh Hashanah of the month of Elul, all the laws of Yom Kippur. We have one guy here. Okay, if a person's wife is pregnant, does she fast on Yom Kippur? So, Bezrat Hashem, you have to know that. You have to know the laws of Sukkos. How to build a sukkah at Lulav, Esrog. You're all going to buy that. How do you buy it on Shemitah? You're not allowed to purchase fruits on Shemitah. Where do you buy it from? Which is more of a question next year than this year. This year they'll make sure to pick it all before Shemitah, hopefully. So that's just a list of things that we have to prepare. So Moshe Rabbeinu taught us in our parsha, even though he had taught the Jewish people the laws of Pesach, when it came close to the time of Pesach, he reviewed all these laws with them. And that's something every person should do. You should have this as a cycle in your learning. At this stage, it'll be Kitzur Shulchan Aruch and Chai Adam. Later on, hopefully, you'll review Masechtas. So now would be a time to review Tanis and Rosh Hashanah and Yuma and Sukkah and Beitza and Chagiga. These are all Masechtas that are relevant to the next few months. So that's what Moshe teaches us in our parsha. Get ready when it's the season. And it's a good idea, by the way, to have this Seder with your wives. I could tell you something which I heard of a family that does it. I've heard of one, so I guess it's feasible. That they all wake up early and they eat breakfast. And after breakfast, they all have 2 minutes where they sit down with the mother. And the mother learns with the children 2 halachas that are relevant to the Yom Tov that's coming up. 2 halachas, and that's how they start their day. I think it's a beautiful idea. I mean, halvai, if anyone can do it, tell me. In next year's class, I'll be able to say, I know 2 families that do it. It's difficult to wake up that early and get everyone set up and ready early, but it's a nice way. Nice way to begin the day. If you can't do it in the morning, do it at night. But everyone should be preparing for the Yom Tov coming up. Okay, let's move forward. So we hit Pesach and there are people who are defiled. So one opinion says they were taking Nadav and Aviv. Another opinion says they were carrying the casket that Yosef was buried in. And the third opinion, Rav Yitzchak says, that doesn't make sense. Because Nadav and Aviv passed away the first of Nisan. So you have 14 days till Pesach. Why would they still be defiled if they took care of Nadav and Aviv? The casket of Yosef, well, the Paradumo was burnt on the 2nd of Nisan. So you have 13 days to prepare for the Korban Pesach. So why would they be defiled from that? So this opinion, Rav Yitzchak says, they found the Meis Mitzvah. They were wandering and they found a body, a corpse. And the halacha says that even though it's 7 days before Pesach, and if one gets defiled from touching that meis mitzvah, he won't be able to bring korban Pesach. The first responsibility is to take care of kvod abrios. You have a body here. We have to honor it and give it proper burial. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, we're in the desert. We're all family. We have 600,000 Jews. How exactly is there a meis mitzvah? How is there someone who passed away that no one knew who he was? So maybe if we have time in the class, we'll get back to that. So they said, we can't bring Pesach offering on this day. Meaning, if it were only tomorrow, we'd be okay. So their question was, by nightfall, we'll be pure. Could we ask people to bring the sacrifice for us when we'll be fully pure at night when it's time to eat the Paschal offering? Their 7 days ended that night. So they said they'll bring the sacrifice when we're still defiled. But we'll be able to eat it at night when we become pure. So Moshe says, I don't know, let me ask God. And this is the praise of Moshe, that Moshe could say, I'll ask God, he'll answer me. It's like, let me just pick up the phone and ask. What the Lubavitcher Rebbe said, we have to learn from these people. There were two groups of people who stepped forward and said, we don't want to be left out. One is these people. They said, Lama nigara, why should we be left out? I don't want to be left out. We want part of the mitzvah. And the other is the daughters of Tzlafchad. They said, why should we lose out the portion in the land of Israel? Our father didn't have any sons. Why should our father's name be lost? And Lubavitcher Rebbe said, we all have to learn from that. That when it comes to spiritual things, we should say, I don't want to be left out. Why should I lose out? The Torah tells us that when the Jews traveled, God guided them. And we have four psukim describing that. And the question is, why is that so important? So the Rambam explains that this is teaching us a fundamental point in Jewish philosophy. The Rambam says we traveled a journey that should have taken 11 days and it took us a long, long time traveling from Horeh to Kadesh Barnea. 40 years took us to get to there because God decreed that we would spend 40 years in the desert. So it's 11 days journey. What exactly took us so long? So the Rambam says the nations had spies following us wherever we went. And they kept thinking, where are the Jews headed now? We know they're supposed to come to the Holy Land. Now they're going north. Now they're going south. Now they're going east. Now they're going west. What's going on with these people? Where are they headed? And the nations looked at our journeys and they thought they're confused. They just don't know where they're supposed to go. And God said, I have my plan. You go where I tell you to go. And the Jews didn't know where they were headed. Here God's telling them to go this direction. It seems like we were going in circles. So the Rambam says that the psukim stress that God was guiding us wherever we went to tell us that whenever we have questions about what God's doing, we have to know there's a reason. We don't necessarily know it today. But there is a godly plan, and we might not know the reason. The pasuk says in the description of the Torah, Ki lo davar reku mikem. The Torah is not something that's empty from you. The Torah has content and has what to offer you. So our sages said you have to break up the pasuk differently. Ki lo davar reku. It's not something empty. And if you think it's empty, the imreku, if you think it's empty, mikem, then you're the one that's missing it. It's not that the Torah is lacking, we're lacking in our understanding. So sometimes we are lacking. We have to know to say we're lacking. There are certain things that Chazal tell us that we could say, yeah, that's what it is, or we could say, I don't understand. And an intelligent person says, I don't understand. We're going to hit Rosh Hashanah, and our sages say, you blow shofar, and you stop a day before Rosh Hashanah, and then you blow it on Rosh Hashanah, and you confuse the Satan, and he thinks it's the day of doomsday, and he runs, and he doesn't speak badly about us. So you'll hear a lot of people quote that and nod their head and say, yeah, right, it's true, it's a Gemara, that's what it says. But if you ask yourself what it means, so then if you have an answer, tell me, because I don't. Okay, I don't know. It does say it in the Gemara. If I was in fifth grade, I might buy it. At this age, so I know it's true, I just don't know what it means. So we have to be truthful and say, I don't understand. But we also have to know that it's I who don't understand. It's not something lacking in the Torah. I don't understand. Very often that's a sign you could tell where a person's holding. When a person asks a question, does he say, it doesn't make sense? Or he says, it doesn't make sense to me. That's a question of where we're holding. If we've learned and we value what the Torah is, so we recognize it doesn't make sense to me. I don't understand. And that's why the Rambam says the Torah stresses that our travelings were all guided by God to tell us no one understood what we were doing. The Jews didn't understand and the non-Jews didn't understand. God guided us, but God was guiding us. There was a heavenly cloud guiding us and we went where God told us to go. The Torah says that when the cloud rose in the morning, the Jews would follow it, and the Torah indicates to us how careful God was. He didn't start the journey in the middle of the day. Whenever journeys started, God would always start in the morning, so that people had time to prepare, pack up their kids, pack up their stuff, and go. Moshe is told to prepare the trumpets, and the trumpets are something that was special for Moshe. When Moshe died, the trumpets were buried. God gives him exact directions how to blow the trumpets, to gather the people, to tell people to travel. There were different ways of blowing the trumpets to signify different things. The Torah tells us we have mitzvah to have trumpets. The question is why we don't have trumpets today, and that's why the Rabbanut instituted to have trumpets today. The Torah seems to indicate it's an institution for generations. If you ever go to the Kotel when they have a gathering of prayer of that the Rabbanut calls for people to gather in prayer, so one of the things that was instituted, I think it was in Rabbi Shapiro and Rabbi Eliyahu's time, is that they have Kohanim there blowing solid silver trumpets, because the Torah says that when we're in a time of need, then one of the ways we pray is by blowing the trumpets. Now, what does that mean? So one understanding is that trumpets is like shofar, that it's a way of wailing. If you have a child that wants something, so he could ask for it, or he could just come and cry. When we cry, that's a clear message from our heart. The greatest people cried. David HaMelech cried. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi cried. Crying is a sign of purity. It's a sign of connection. It's a sign that I'm willing to let my soul speak. When our souls are blocked, so then we're scared of crying. It's rare that you see a person today standing in prayer and crying. And when you see a person crying, so you ask yourself, what's wrong with him? What's going on? But in truth, prayer, it's our sages taught us that when all the gates are sealed, the gates of crying aren't sealed. The Gemara tells us that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was once standing and a goat was crying and it ran behind him. And Rabbi Yehuda said, what are you crying for? This is what you were created for. They want to take you to slaughter. That's what you were created for. So God punished Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. And Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi got a terrible toothache. And he wasn't cured. For a long, long time he was suffering. And all the time that he suffered, no woman miscarried in Israel. But he suffered. And he suffered in his mouth for what he said. So the first question we have to ask ourselves is, since when do you hear a goat cry? What does it mean that a goat was crying and Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi heard it? He must have had special ears to hear a goat cry. I mean, you don't usually see a goat cry. So, and
how do you connect the childbirth?
Good question. That's something maybe, if you remind me, maybe we could take a Thursday night to discuss it. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi would pour down tears in his prayer. And this was a trait that we see throughout the house of David, that they let their neshama come forth. So the wailing of a shofar, the wailing of a chatzotra, Rav Hershel Schechter said in the Shir, is representative of crying. That's clean prayer. But there's another understanding here, that the Torah is saying you blow the trumpets when the sacrifices are brought, and that signifies to the Jewish people the sacrifices are being brought for them. And then the law focus, the sacrifice, God accept our sacrifice, it's representative of all of us. And that's how we gain atonement and God's forgiveness. Yeah? It's a good question. Why was he wrong? So our sages say he should have had more compassion. That's not the way you talk to a goat. Even though that is what the goat was created for. No, but if the goat is crying, and so that we have to, maybe tomorrow night. I wanted to have a class on this Gemara. Maybe tomorrow night, I hope we'll have time. We'll deal with this Gemara. What was Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi supposed to do? What's going on here? So, we blow the trumpets. And the trumpets signify a basic tenet of Jewish faith, that when something goes wrong, we recognize that God is running the show. We have a mitzvah to pray. We have a mitzvah to blow trumpets. We have a mitzvah to gather and say, wait a second, what did we do wrong? Fix ourselves in the hope, in the prayer that God will fix the situation. That's a recognition that there's hashgacha. The Torah, in commanding us, get together, blow trumpets, pray, is telling us, take heed. If something goes wrong, don't say, yeah, it's nature, you know, things can go bad. No, stop and say, wait a second, what are we doing wrong? The Torah tells us that when the Jews would travel, the tribe of Dan, who was in the north, would expand. They'd have so many people that they'd expand all along the western front, and they'd pick up the rear. They weren't really supposed to pick up the rear, but because that's such a great population, they'd end up encompassing the whole western side as well as the northern side. And whenever someone would slow down, he'd know if he'd hit the tribe of Dan, I got to speed up because if I'm behind them, I'm all alone. And if someone would lose something, so then the tribe of Dan would always collect it and bring it back. So you ask yourself, you know what? There are 600,000 people here. And that's only men. Double that for women. Add to that for children. We have 2 million people. The whole tribe of Dan is busy collecting things. That's a little bit complicated. How they did Hashavas Aveda. But we see that they didn't give up. It's one of the things that we have to think about. Like very often, it's easy to say, well, why should I stop and pick that up? There are so many things scattered around. But that's the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda, that when we can, we return things. The Torah tells us that Moshe spoke to Yisrael and said, we're going into the land of Israel. Join. Really? Let's go back a year. Moshe standing before God and saying, God, how could you do this to the Jewish people? How could it be? I came to speak to Pharaoh and things just got worse. And God tells Moshe, okay, now you're going to see the miracles I'll do. And God clearly indicates to Moshe, now you will see, but because you spoke this way, when it comes time to enter the land of Israel, you won't see. So Moshe has already been foretold that he will not lead the Jewish people into the land of Israel. So how come he turns to his father-in-law and says, Dad, we're all going in now, join. So one understanding is that he wasn't aware of the decree yet. The decree is going to be when he hits the rock. God had foretold him in an illusion that he might not enter or he will not enter, but it wasn't yet decreed, so Moshe believed he would enter. But we have a tradition that Moshe knew he wasn't entering. But Moshe said, if I go and tell the Jewish people I'm not going in, they're all going to say, we're not going in. How can we make it without you? Moshe was concerned, if I tell Yisro I'm not going in, then Yisro is going to say, you're not going in, I'm not going in. Or possibly Moshe thought, I won't lead them in, but I'll go in on my own. So Moshe tells Yisro, we're all going in, join us. Because Moshe thinks in 3 days they're going to be in the land of Israel, which was the godly plan. We messed up. You enter, and we'll make good to you, Moshe says. I can't give you part of the land, but we'll have booty, we'll have loot, we'll help you out. And from here we see, if you want to look at current events, we see that Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't going the route of Wolfowitz.
What?
Wolfowitz, the head of the World Bank. It was just deposed, right? Moshe Rabbeinu is on the top. He's running the show. As far as he thinks, he's leading us into the land of Israel. Moshe still abides by the law. He tells Yisro, come in, we'll give you what we can, but I can't give you part of the land. You're a ger, I can't give you part of the land. So Moshe Rabbeinu isn't taking the route of politician. Moshe isn't promising something he can't give. He's telling him, we'll make good for you as much as we can. And Yisro says, you're telling me you'll make good? Well, I know I have it good back in Midian. I'm going back home. And Moshe begs him, please don't leave. If we haven't been good enough to you yet, then from now on, we'll keep our eye on you. If we haven't been good enough yet, we'll be better to you from now on.
Why is Moshe so worried?
Moshe's concerned, if Yisro leaves, people will say, I didn't mean it, he's not a real ger. And I think we have to stop here and look at this. Because very often when people become gerim, after they finish their gear, it gets tough. And then it gets tougher. And then it gets even tougher. And it's not easy making aliyah. And it's not easy becoming a ger. And if you look around and you ask other gerim, you'll see that most of them have it tough. Financially, religiously, socially, and they come to Israel, and it's not easy. And some leave. We have people who learned here in Machon Meir, and they left. And they're keeping Torah, but they're keeping Torah out in the wilderness because it was easier to go back to where they came from. This dilemma that's facing Yisro is a dilemma that faces every single ger. When you're faced with entering a land where you don't have what everyone else has, you don't have the family to back you. You don't have the social context. You're not part of the social system. So everyone could say, I love you. The Torah promise tells us we have to give extra special treatment to a ger, and we try to do it. But at the end of the day, no one's paying your bills. Moshe's telling Yisro, you're entering an agrarian society, and you're not going to have a piece of land. But we'll do as best as we can to help you. Don't leave. And Yisro says, but back home I have all my assets. I have my plot of land. You're saying you'll make good. I could have it good, not you'll make good. Moshe tells him, when things will get better for us, we'll make it better for you. We can't give you part of the land of Israel, but God promises us that He'll help us conquer beyond the land of Israel. So when we conquer the lands beyond the land of Israel, we'll give you part of that. And Torah doesn't tell us what Yisrael did. When we enter the books of prophets, we find that Yisrael's descendants are in the land of Israel and they make good. They become chief rabbis. They're the Talmidim of Osniel ben Kenaz, the Shofet. When Osniel ben Kenaz yells out to God, send me some righteous students, so Yisrael's descendants, they come there. When Shaul makes war with Amalek, so he sends word to Yisrael's descendants, he says, stay clear, I don't want you guys to get hurt when I'm making this war. Which seems to indicate that Yisrael's descendants were not living within the land of Israel. They didn't have a portion in the land. So long as the Jews had not yet built the temple, so the Jews had said, we'll take the land of Jericho. The land of Jericho grows amazing fruits. Way out into the sea, when people would be approaching the land of Israel, they'd smell the great persimmons in the land of Jericho, and that's why it was called Yericho, like Reach, because they'd smell the land of Israel and they'd bless the land of Israel. They'd say, wow, look at what a smell. But bottom line, when the Jews conquered the Jericho, they said, we're not going to rebuild Jericho, and Yisrael's offsprings could stay here and live off the fat of the land until we build the temple. When we build the temple, whichever tribe gives up of their land to build the temple, they get the land of Jericho. And so Yisrael's offspring became nomads. They lived in tents. And they were very pious people. And Jeremiah, the prophet, tells the Jewish people, look at Yisrael's offspring, the children of Yondav ben Rechav. They don't drink wine. They live in tents. They don't have homes. And they're pious people. They're good people. Learn from them. And it seems that Yisrael joined us. Whether he joined us now or he joined us later is unclear. The Torah doesn't say what the bottom line was. But we have to recognize that the dilemma that's facing Yisrael is a dilemma that faces every single ger. And if Yisrael would have gone back to the lands of his family, he would have had it easier financially. He would have had it easier socially, possibly. But in the long term, he would have died out. When a ger chooses to tough it out and stay here, he's toughing it out for future generations. It's not going to get easier for him. His children might have it easier. His grandchildren will hopefully have it easier. But the Gemara tells us that for generations it's difficult for a ger. There's always that feeling inside, well, my grandfather is non-Jewish. I have a friend who's getting married now. And his grandfather is a very respectable judge in a European country. And he's non-Jewish. This guy became a ger. Not here at Machon Meir. Elsewhere. And he told me once, he said, wait, I still have a grandfather. So halachically he doesn't. Halachically that's not his grandfather. Halachically when a person becomes a ger, he's starting fresh. It's like he's born fresh. And that's not easy. But there's always that urge, maybe I should go back. I do have a wealthy grandfather. I do have family out there. And this is a challenge that faces every single ger. And we see that Moshe Rabbeinu tries to help him and tell him, look, it'll be good. Come with us. Join us. And we don't know what Yisrael's final call was. We know ultimately he made it. But according to some understandings, he first went back. He went back home, tried to convince his family that this was the way to go. And then finally he rejoined us. He regrouped with the Jewish people and entered the land of Israel. Just a second, yeah.
But to a certain extent, you were saying about the issues with the Ger during Aliyah. Many Jewish people have the same issues too.
It's and easier.
Ashkenazi families in America and so forth, where they really have some relatives here, it's still the same issues.
No,
work is still the same.
It's not the same issues, because the change emotionally that a ger has to do causes it to be that a ger will always feel himself a stranger. When a Jew comes into the land of Israel, an Ashkenazi Jew who has no family, he walks into shul, he's familiar with what's going on. It's much easier to connect socially. It's much easier to feel at home. When a ger walks in, so a ger is walking in and he's new. He's different. Moshe Rabbeinu, one of the reasons he tries to encourage Yisrael to come is he says, Vayita lanu le'inayim, you'll be a prototype. People will look at you and say, you see, you could make it. Look at Yisrael. You'll be representative of what a ger can be. But it's not easy. When a ger comes in, he's changing everything in his life. And to change everything, plus have to deal with the economical hardships, that's tough. And it's tough also because when a person has to wake up every morning and deal with the Yetzer Hara, and wake up every morning and deal with, okay, so what do I have to do now? It's a new life. This isn't the way I grew up. and I don't have my family's back, and I might have a family that's egging me on to come back. Many Gerim have that their family says, hey, have you had enough? Have you done your stint? So you've had your midlife crisis, you've had your teenage years, fine, enough, come back. Many Gerim live that way. We see Unkelus lived that way. His uncle kept trying to bring him back. It's not easy. And as old as a person may be, a person still has his old habits. And old habits, they say, die hard. I don't know if they ever die. Old habits stay within. They're always lurking. And our sages taught us that for a ger, that could take 10 generations, that this feeling is always lurking. So Yisroel has it tough, but he makes it. And he is Vaitalanu Leinaim. He is representative for other gerim to learn from. But that doesn't mean it's easy. Whenever the Torah tells us, be kind to the poor, so the Torah says, Almana Yosom Ger. A widow, she has no husband to fend for her. An orphan, he has no parent to fend for him. And a ger. And I always wondered, why should a ger be so badly off? Maybe he's coming in with $1 million in his knapsack. And experience has taught me that it doesn't work that way. That financially it is difficult, the second a person is a ger. It's difficult. So Moshe tries to allay Israel's fears. He tells them, you know, God promises us we'll conquer other nations, and from there we will be able to give you part of the land. Some want to say that Moshe promised him the land that was called the land of the Cani. We find that in Avram's time, the Torah describes the land of the Cani. So some want to say, we see that Israel is called Cani, and that was land externally, and that was land that Israel was given. But this doesn't have such strong sources. Right, they're referred to as Canaan. Yisrael's family is referred to as Canaan. So some want to say the reason is because they got the land of the Canaan. That's what Moshe promises him in our parsha. But that's a Chizkuni. And they haven't found a source for this Chizkuni. Chizkuni says, some say. Who are those some that say? I don't know. Yeah.
The issue is the land.
A ger could purchase land in Israel, but he doesn't get part of the division of the land. Any other Jew, by the fact that he's part of a tribe, it automatically means that he's supposed to inherit a certain part of the land of Israel. Part of his tribe he's entitled to. And then Shemitah, in Yovel, he gets it back. A ger, even if he purchases land, when Yovel comes, it's going to go back to its original owner. He doesn't have any part of the land of Israel, per se, that belongs to him. Yeah. There is a place that the prophets promised that Gerim will have parts of the land. But we see this was a common problem. That if you're coming into the people of Israel, what do you have? Don't forget, we're talking about a time where people primarily made money off of land. It was an agrarian culture.
Logistically also.
Just a second. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sorry.
Logistically it's also was
allotted. So realistically it wasn't so difficult because the Jewish people didn't keep Shemitah and Yovel. So they didn't keep Yovel, so when they purchased a piece of land it became theirs. And a ger was as badly off as everyone else. Meaning the Jewish, in an empirical sense, the Torah says keep Shemitah, keep Yovel, the land has to go back. The Jewish people did not keep it. And because they didn't keep it, so when you purchased the plot of land, it was yours, the way you'd think it should be, the way it would be if not for the Lord of Yovel. This was a mitzvah that the Jewish people did not keep. Bottom line, the Jews did not keep not Shemitah, not Yovel. They didn't keep it, as far as I know. They might have kept the first Yovel, the Gemara discusses. They didn't keep it. No, the Jewish people didn't keep it. The rabbis tried. No one listened.
And this isn't brought anywhere as a reason for our being cast out of the land.
It is brought. The Navi says, because we didn't keep Shemitah and Yovel, we'll be kicked out. The Torah foretells us that will happen. And then the Navi says, this is what's going to happen. And then the Navi says, this is what happened. Yeah. So the Jews are traveling. We leave Sinai. We've been there almost a year. And the Jews leave. And now suddenly they have to face up to life after Sinai. And now they're entering a desert. And it's not as comfortable as it was by Sinai, which was near Oasis territory, near civilization. And now people start saying, hey, how are we going to live out here? What are we going to eat? What are we going to drink? They've had mun until now. They keep having mun, but it's getting tiresome to be in the desert. We're there all of 3 days. But the people, the edge of the camp, the Erev Rav start complaining. And they're looking for what to complain about. So God sends a heavenly fire, and the heavenly fire scorches the 70 elders. If you recall, when we were standing at Sinai, the elders were called forth with Moshe, and together with Moshe, they saw a vision of God's heavenly fire. Moshe Rabbeinu wouldn't look, Aaron didn't look, Yoshua didn't look, the elders, they look. They're standing, they're eating their sacrifice, and looking at God. It's like a servant that comes before the master, and he takes a bite out of bread and starts talking and just munching away. Now that's disrespectful, and they deserve to die on the spot. But God said, now the Torah is going to be given, I don't want them to drop dead now. So God held off. And now when we leave Sinai and the Jewish people sin and God wants to punish the Jewish people, God takes the 70 elders and they all drop dead. And now Moshe finds himself leaving the Jewish people all alone. All his assistants, from the day he entered Egypt, 3 years ago when he entered before Pharaoh, what was the first thing he did? He went to the elders. The Jews had 70 elders in Egypt. He went to the elders and said, God sent me, time to leave Egypt. From that day on, Moshe Rabbeinu was leading the Jewish people with the elders at his side. And now, all the elders died. And now the Jews complain again. The rest of the Jews start clambering and complaining. And here we have two understandings among our sages. One understanding is the Pesukim should be read literally. They said back in Egypt when the Nile would overflow, so we'd have pits next to the Nile. And then when the Nile would recede, so we'd have pits filled with water and fish. We'd go drawing water, we'd have fish in the water. So our sages tell us that it's true. That when God made a special blessing that the Jews, whenever a woman would go to the well to draw water, she'd get water filled with fish. So this is how it happened when the Nile overflowed. So the water with the fish would go out. This is one of the ways, by the way, guys, those of you who go out to nature, this is one of the ways you could fish, right? You go to the beach and you make holes. This is an ancient way of fishing. You make pits, and then when the tide goes up, so fish get caught in those holes, and then when the tide goes down, so you go and check those pits, and you find some of them will have fish. This is an ancient way of fishing. So the Jews in Egypt said, we used to get fish for free. We'd just draw water. We'd have fish. We'd have all kinds of spices to spice our meat with. Okay, so I guess you have to know how to do it. You have to do it with rocks, maybe, not with sand. So they say now all we have to eat is the mun. And the mun was really a wonderful food, but the Jews were looking for complaints. They were looking to complain. And that's why when a person wants to complain, so he'll find what to complain about. Yeah. So in the first complaint it says that the Erev Rav complained. In the second complaint it says Vasafsufa Shelbi Kaboy Tavutava. The Erev Rav were the ones that were looking for what they wanted. The Jewish people, once the Erev Rav started complaining, they joined forces with them, and it seems like everyone joined in the complaint. Yeah. They got everyone else to complain with them. And just 1 second, Yosef, yeah?
What is the difference between the Pasuk and Mary? Says it was evil in the ears of Hashem, and then Hashem heard. What's the distinction?
Where? Which Pasuk?
Aleph.
Yud Aleph?
Aleph.
Right. So that our sages say they were looking to complain in the ears of Hashem. The nation was looking for complaints. They were interested in getting riling up against Hashem. And God heard and God was upset. The people were looking to, so to speak, get back at Hashem. So they had been at Sinai and things were wonderful. And once they left Sinai, it's like when you leave yeshiva. Now you have to fend for yourself, and suddenly, I have to get up an extra half hour early to make it to Minyan. I have to plan my day differently because of all these things. It's difficult. When you're at Sinai, it's easier. When you leave Sinai, then it gets difficult. Now, what were they complaining about? So one understanding says it's to be understood literally. Another tradition we have is that they were complaining about women. This was a clean way of complaining about women. When they said, "Ashanochal b'mitzrayim chinam," we ate for free. That's like the verse states in Mishlei, "Achata u'machata fia v'amra lo fa'alti aven." that the woman who is this faithful, she eats and wipes herself clean and then says, I did nothing wrong. And that's an allusion to doing improper things with improper mates. That eating in Tanakh can be referred to eating or it can be referred to something else, using a clean tongue. So when they said we used to be eating in Egypt for free, they meant in Egypt we could do whatever we wanted. There was no Torah. Now God tells us you're not allowed to marry this woman, you're not allowed to marry that woman, you have to be faithful to your wife, you have to be faithful to your husband. Suddenly life is changing. And they said it was easier for us in Egypt. The Gemara discusses if a person is a non-Jewish slave and he wants to be Megayer his son. So the Gemara says when the kid is still a child, so then we say you could be Megayer a kid even though he doesn't know about it because it's a schus for him. Once a kid becomes 13, so we say you can't do it against his better judgment. So the question is why? We say in general you can do something positive for someone even if they don't know, because we say if it's good for them then they're happy, so you can represent them. The Torah teaches us you could do it. So the Gemara says once a kid reaches maturity and he's lived the unruly life of a slave where he has female slaves available whenever he wants, so you could tell him from today until tomorrow, it's good, be Jewish. Be Jewish, I'm doing you the biggest favor in the world. But he doesn't feel it. So long as he's a youngster and he hasn't experienced that, so then you tell him, this is a better life. I'm going to free you, I'm going to make you Jewish. That's good for him. But the second a person has lived the unruly life, the life where promiscuity is rampant, you can do what you want. So then he doesn't want the constraints of the Torah. He has to mature within himself and want it. And when you'll try to tell him, I'm doing something to your benefit, he's not going to agree. So the Jewish people had lived a life where they could do whatever they wanted. And now God picked up Sinai and said, you want my Torah or you want to be dead? So Jews said, we want. We're all for it. But now they leave Sinai and they say, hey, wait a second. It's not so much fun. We remember when things were free. We used to eat fish. We could eat it whenever we wanted, which could mean we would eat fish without making a blessing. We would eat fish without having to worry about the halachas. Or it could mean we would have whatever women we wanted whenever we wanted. And now, look at what life is like. So going back to the understanding that they're complaining about the man, the Torah tells us that the man was so beautiful that you could have it whenever you wanted. If a person was righteous, it would fall next to his doorstep. If a person was less righteous, it would fall further away. Everyone would have this meter every morning. They'd know where they were holding spiritually. Just look at where his man fell. He's not fit, so it's way out there. Yeah.
Is that a little embarrassing?
Yeah.
If you go just back to the time when
depending on what you put in, will define what comes out. When a person tries to shoot up 49 steps in 49 days, then what happens is he shoots up, he gets the Torah, but it hasn't been built with strong foundations. It hasn't been built gradually. And so shortly thereafter, they sin with the Egel. And shortly thereafter, we have what we have here. It's difficult to shoot up and stay up.
Well, then what's the value of these 40 days?
Right? Good question.
I thought it was something very special.
It is very special. It is very special to go from the depths to the top. Right? It is very special. But at the same time, it lacks a certain foundation, which when a person builds more gradually, he has. It's one of the things that people have to be very careful about here in Machon Meir. Everyone's shooting up. That's great. But you have to build gradually as well. You have to have something that's going to remain. Meaning, we don't judge a person's success by his spiritual highs when he's in Machon Meir. It's very good. You walk into Machon Meir, things are great. You're shooting up. The question is, where are you going to be a year from now? Where are you going to be 5 years after the Machon? I believe that the success of a person's learning at Machon Meir is measured 5-10 years after the Machon. Thank you. And that's something to think about when we're building ourselves here towards the future. We have 2 more minutes, so I want to run forward for a second. Moshe Avinu says, where am I going to get... So Moshe, that's why Moshe in this situation says, God, how can I handle this alone? Because until now, Moshe had the 70 elders. And now Moshe says, I can't handle this alone. So God says, choose 70 people. Moshe says, if I tell the Jewish people that each tribe has 6 representatives and two tribes have 5 representatives, that's how we get 70 elders. But 2 tribes are going to have 5 representatives. No one's going to listen to me. And here we see the wisdom of Moshe Rabbeinu. A leader has to know when he will be listened to, and a leader has to know when he won't be listened to. Sometimes people think, well, he's my son. I'll tell him what to do. He'll listen to me. It doesn't work that way. Sometimes people will say, what do you mean? I'm the husband. Why? My wife doesn't trust me in Allah. I'm going to say, this is what we have to do. This is what we'll do. And a smart person knows that doesn't work that way. There was no greater leader than Moshe Rabbeinu. And there was no greater prophet than Moshe Rabbeinu. And yet he knew that if he's going to come and tell the Jewish people, 10 tribes will have 6 representatives, and 2 tribes will have 5 representatives, then everyone's going to protest. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, okay, we'll make lots. We'll make 70 pieces of paper that say Zakein, elder, and 2 pieces of paper that go blank. And everyone will draw lots, and the 2 people that get blanks won't go out. So, 2 people don't go out. Eldad and Medad. And it's unclear whether this was their real name or not. And it is unclear whether they got the blank pieces of paper, or they didn't get the blank pieces of paper, but they felt we're not worthy for going out. So they stayed inside the camp. All the other people that went out of the camp, they got Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy. Like one candle lights another candle, he didn't lose anything and they gained. That's the classical understanding that your children are going to come home from gone with. But there's another understanding here. There's another understanding that God said, Moshe, you said I can't handle this. I didn't think you couldn't handle this. I thought you could handle this. But you said, I can't handle this, God. So you know what? Moshe, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take from your spirit and give it to them. Meaning, it's not that they're going to have something and you're not going to lack, which is the traditional understanding. But there's another understanding in our sages that says God told Moshe, I'll take from you and give them what they're going to have, you're going to lack. And now you'll have 70 people. Your strength is going to be divided over 70, but it's not. But you're going to lose that value of 70 that they gain. And you'll see that with 70 you'll succeed, and you could have succeeded without them. But you began by saying, I can't. If you begin by saying, I can't, okay, I'll show you. You could have. But now, I'll give it to other people as well. 2 people in the camp merit to have their own prophecy. And this is a danger. When you have 70 prophets outside the camp prophesizing, sometimes when a person's so great, he has to be outside. These 2 people were within the camp prophesizing. This was endangering the people, and that's why they got scared. And they run out and they say, how are we going to do this? Moshe says, don't worry. This is what everyone should aspire to. I'm not worried about competition. Let everyone grow. And that's a sign of a really great person. We're going to skip to the story of Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam. What were they discussing? So one understanding says that Miriam turned to her sister-in-law and said, Tzipora, where's your jewelry? I don't see you dressing up anymore. And Tzipora said, well, your brother's not interested. There's no point in dressing up. This shows us something. We have a pious woman like Tzipora and a pious woman like Miriam. And what are they talking about jewelry? Miriam says to Tzipora, why aren't you dressing up? There's a misconception today that people think that if you're pious, you don't dress up. If you're pious, part of being pious is not to be beautiful. The word sanua comes from the word hatsneya, hidden. Doesn't mean ugly. It means hidden. It means concealed. Modesty does not mean a lack of beauty. Modesty means covering the beauty. So Miriam asks Tzipora, hey, what's going on? And Tzipora says innocently, there's no point. And Miriam goes to the big brother Aaron and wants to figure out how are we going to help Moshe out. But she assumes that she can equate Moshe with herself. And that is her mistake. And we'll pick up on this tomorrow. Maybe we'll add 2 more points. They speak about the Isha Kushit, the black woman that Moshe took. Who is this black woman? So one understanding, the classical understanding, is that it's Tzipora. Tzipora is called the black woman because she was exceptional, like a black person seems exceptional among white people. What? There's an understanding that says that she was black.
Kush is a geographical area.
Kush is the son of Ham.
Yeah. It also represents that area where they settled.
That's the area they settled in. So the people of Kush were black. So, yeah, David.
There's something that is super related that I don't understand. Why is she speaking about something that belongs to no one else than to her and her husband?
Maybe we'll get to that tomorrow. That's longer than 1 second. We'll try to get to that tomorrow. So, one understanding says that Miriam says to Aaron, I know she's black. I know she's not good looking. But that's who he married. He knew what she looked like. Why? How could he do this to her? To separate from her. She's his wife. He chose her. Her looks didn't change. That's a non-conventional understanding that's quoted. Another non-conventional understanding that's quoted is that it says there are books of stories about Moshe. And one of those stories says that he went out and married the queen of Cush. And he never lived with her. Now these stories, some sources say they're ridiculous. You shouldn't even look at them. And some Rishonim quote them. So the Rishonim that quote them say that the conversation went like this. Miriam said, how did he marry this queen of Cush when he never lives with her as a wife? What's going on here? What did he marry her for? And then God said, wait a second, what are you intervening? You're talking about your brother? Now, they meant for good. Whatever their conversation was, Aaron and Miriam meant for good. Their thoughts were, how can we help Moshe? But they had a conversation they shouldn't have had, and their conversation was predicated upon an understanding that they weren't allowed to have. They thought they can understand Moshe and understand what's going on by him, which is something we should think about. Sometimes in life, we allow ourselves to say and do things because we think we understand other people. And in truth, we're not even allowed to enter that realm. There was a chassan whose kala didn't have any money. The parents couldn't participate in anything. And the kala got a loan to get a wedding gown. And after she got the wedding gown, she decided it's not the color she wants. So she spent 3,000-4,000 shekel getting the gown after she chose it. And she doesn't have any money. And then she decides she needs a different gown. So the chassan called me up to discuss something totally different. But he mentioned this to me. So I said to him, well, what are you, did you say anything? So he said to me like this. He said, you taught me once that there are areas that I don't have a right to have an opinion. And I believe this is one of those areas. That it's not that I'm allowed to have an opinion, but I have to shut my mouth and not say anything. I don't have a right to have an opinion. I don't begin to understand what a girl is, what a wedding gown is to a girl, what a wedding is to a girl, and what any of this means there. I don't have a right to an opinion. This is what he quoted to me. So I said, right, that's what I was going to tell you. Yeah, kol kavod, right? Okay, fine. So Miriam and Aaron, they entered an opinion about something which God says, wait a second, you're not in the same picture. You don't begin to understand Moshe. You don't. You're not where Moshe is. So you don't understand. You don't need to understand. And maybe tomorrow we'll be able to continue a little bit more on the part.